Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. In this episode, I speak to Danielle Chelosky, whose work I've admired for quite a while. Danielle is a poet, essayist, and music journalist whose work has appeared in Stereogum, Uproxx, The Fader, and Billboard. She just published her brand new book, Pre-Gaming Grief, a part memoir, part confessional, pandemic-era love story that deals with confusion, loss, fast cars, and the allure of self-destructive romantic dalliances. Danielle and I discuss her willingness to bear it all and why that honesty is something that readers deeply crave, even when it makes them uncomfortable. We also discuss the wild ride of the 2010s Tumblr era of the internet, and why Joyce Manor is the best band of all time. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. Danielle Chelosky, welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy.
Thank you. You said my last name so correct. That's awesome.
I love being so correct. So I guess like to start a little bit like from the beginning, you have a lot of your roots in Long Island from what I understand and from what I've read about you. Is that where you grew up?
Yes, and it is where I am now. Yeah, I was born here and I lived in Brooklyn for a year and I lived in Pennsylvania for a year, but otherwise, also I went to college in Westchester, so that was a couple years, but otherwise, been on Long Island.
Yeah, and how is that sort of, do you feel like it helps you sort of having that place where, you know, you go into the city and you can have your night and go out, engage in all the debauchery, and then kind of like come home and like sort of decompress in your spacious apartment? Do you feel like that's benefited you?
Yeah, I mean, right now I'm just living with my mom, so I have a whole house here. It's pretty nice. But yeah, like I really enjoy the proximity to the city without having to live there. When I lived in Brooklyn, I'm just not used to things being loud. So that was a struggle. Also, cities are just really overwhelming for me. Probably for other people too, but I'm sensitive and it's nice and quiet here and it's a vibe. But yeah, many a nights spent indulging in debauchery and then coming home and I used to have a routine of when I would come home, I would get a White Claw and probably another pack of cigarettes at the gas station by my house. And I would just walk around because it's so empty and you could just do that. And I would just do that. And I would go to Dunkin' Donuts. I would get an egg and cheese on a croissant. It's like 2 a.m. Everything is amazing. And yeah, that was my life for a little bit.
That's great to indulge in. You know what I discovered recently, which is really sad for me, is I seem to have some GI like resistance or intolerance now to the consumption of straight eggs. Like last time I had a bacon egg and cheese or a sausage egg and cheese, I was just like in bed all day, just like, oh. And that pattern is heartbreaking because there's eggs in like everything.
That is a shame. Breakfast food is my favorite food, but honestly, I haven't been having many eggs lately. I go with a bagel every morning because I am insane. It's been like a year of just bagels every morning. And for a while, I was an everything, an egg everything bagel girly with cream cheese. And I ordered it so many times that the people at the bagel place made fun of me. And when I changed my order recently, they were like asking me if I was okay, if I was having a mental crisis. And I was like, please let me order my bagel in peace.
Like, I'm just trying to eat here.
Weird.
So, you're obviously very prolific. Like, just looking at your resume alone, it's like the length of the Bible. It's just so much stuff. Like, you obviously are like a real like hustler, and you work really, really tirelessly and really hard. How long have you been at Stereogum now?
Only since October, but I interned for them in I think 2021 for I don't know how long, probably like 5 months or something. So I kind of feel like I've been here longer. And also I just like hung out with them all in Texas for South by, so that was super fun. But yeah, hopefully I'll be here for a while.
Yeah, and I think I'm maybe, yeah, I'm like 2 years older than you, I think, but like we're close enough in age that we have like the big thing in common for Gen Z girls, especially, is that we were both raised on Tumblr. And I personally, like, for me, I remember using the platform just to honestly live vicariously through the aspirational sort of danger, I guess, because there was a sense of safety in that, like knowing that I would never be the kind of girl who like chain smoked all the time and was living all those Lana Del Rey lyrics. And I never would be, but like living vicariously through the aesthetic and lifestyle on the internet like became somewhat of a fascination, I guess. Because I was bored, you know, growing up in a suburb.
Yeah.
And like when you reflect on that time period, how do you feel about like that particular era of like 2010s internet culture?
Yeah, I mean, what you said is so true. Like, I felt like I was just so privileged and bored and like wanted a sense of danger. And like, I just would watch like GIFs of the 1975 Robbers music video where like, they're like robbing a bank or something, and it's so romantic. But yeah, I mean, I have been using Tumblr again, and it feels so good. I feel like a lot of problems in my life wouldn't exist if I had grown up just using Tumblr and not Instagram and Twitter, because the lack of like an algorithm or like personalities or influencers, like I don't think those exist on Tumblr. Like you can't see how many people follow someone, and it's literally just vibes, and it's so nice. It feels like walking through a museum, like just all the images, like it's so inspiring and like actually artistic. But yeah, that was certainly a time. I was recently like interviewed by a college student about an essay I wrote about that Tumblr era, and she was like too young to experience it, so she was curious about it, and I was like, that's crazy. Like, I feel ancient just relaying my history to you. So, yeah, it obviously was a big moment, and people are like growing up wishing that they were there for it, which is so funny because it was just something that happened on the internet, but it was a moment.
It really was like that Neighborhood album.
Oh my God. Underrated. People don't talk about it. It's
Yeah.
and they're such a weird band, but they were part of the trifecta of like that album, Arctic Monkeys AM, and the 1975 self-titled. Like that was it.
Yeah. Like that was our Beatlemania, like that trifecta, essentially.
Yeah, but we were all like on our beds sitting at our laptops.
Exactly. But also somehow connected. Like, that's the magical and also really like insanely scary thing about the internet and algorithms.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if at the time I realized how big it was. But I mean, I feel like the 1975 is like proof of it, because like they didn't really get critical acclaim or like attention from critics at the time, but they had millions of streams and millions of fans.
Yeah. And now I feel like I thought that was so interesting the way that that perception evolved over the years when they released A Brief Inquiry and people were calling it like the millennial OK Computer. And I was like, that's a bit of a stretch, but like, I'm glad they're having their moment in like a critical sense, I guess.
Oh my God, I did not see that. But I don't know. I kind of dropped off of listening to them after, I guess, after I stopped using Tumblr so much, and after probably the second album, I Like It When You Sleep, came out. And then I just revisited them a couple years ago because of that tour where like no one would shut up about them. And I became a fan again, and it is so nice listening to their first album again. Like, it still hits so hard. The song Sex is so good. The song Chocolate is overrated. I do not like that song.
Like for even like from a compositional standpoint, like there's no build to anything. It's just like do 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 the whole time. That's the song.
Yeah, I think he said. I think, don't quote me on this, but I think he said it's like a parody of a pop song, but still doesn't hit. So that's his fault.
Yeah, so Pre-Gaming Grief, which is out
Yes.
As we speak, reading it made me scream, sob, giggle, kick my feet, all the things. And I've noticed that, like, in your shorter works of writing, you often do, like, remove people's names and simply, like, reduce to mentioning them by letter to protect their identity. In Pre-Gaming Grief, you do use full pseudonyms, so I'm wondering, like, what prompted that change?
Yeah, I tried to use just letters, but it was so hard to follow. Like, it just did not work. So I had to go with fake names. And I used to be very stubborn about that, and I wanted to use real names because I was like, it's a statement, it's real, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think it's that deep. And people have been upset in the past about being in my work, and I don't want to upset people anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. Especially like when it's a longer work and you're just saying like A and G said this
It's
and
so
it's
bad.
over and over
It's
and over again.
awful.
Yeah, and something that I guess the narrator is told in the book as well is that she's good at quote unquote seeking catastrophe. But when you read further into it and get into the revelations about family life and parents and siblings, and it always kind of being chaotic. I kind of like it's pretty easy to put two and two together. Like, do you think that the whole seeking catastrophe stems in a way from like catastrophe being the narrator's normal in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, my therapist said recently that like we're drawn to what we are familiar with and we're familiar with growing up. And I feel like that's such a cliche, but unfortunately, I've realized that a lot of cliches are actually true, which is so annoying. But that's what I've learned from being in therapy.
Yeah. And I read like your interview as well on Rachel Gilman's Substack. And what stood out to me was two things. One was that you don't necessarily vibe with the term autofiction. So, like, it kind of like seems like you expressed it being in sort of like a liminal space between like a nonfiction, but not necessarily a memoir either. Have you figured out at this point what you think you would call it?
Well, I really like what you just said. liminal space. I'm gonna use that now. But for the record, I love a lot of autofiction. My favorite author, Chris Krauss, was like one of the pioneers of autofiction, and she does it so well. But I think it's very trendy right now, and a lot of people suck at it. So that's why. That's where my resentment comes from, I guess.
Right. And the second thing is that, so you're sober now, correct?
I'm like pretty sober. I don't drink like 10 White Claws when I go out anymore, unless I'm at South By, which was a fun little experience. But I'll have like one or two White Claws here or there, and then I'll be like, okay, I'm scared. That's all.
Yeah, I think another thing, like you said, is that you don't think you could travel to Paris because it's just like such a wine saturated culture.
Yes, I love red wine, so I think I would go a little crazy.
Yeah, and I found that really funny because, like, yet two of your biggest influences are French writers.
I do love French writers. I mean, if I have the opportunity to go to France, I'm gonna go to France, but I'm gonna be a little worried while I'm doing it. It'll just be like another South By experience of, okay, there are no rules anymore. But yeah, I get really bad hangovers, so the days are terrible, but the night's really fun.
Yeah, how was South by the way?
It was really fun. I mean, it was my first work trip and it was my first time going to South By. And it was very stressful because I was working, like, still just working and had to be blogging, but also, like, I was under pressure of having to try to catch as many bands as possible in like 3 days. But the last day that I was there was like the Stereo Gum Showcase, and that was a fucking blast. It was so much fun, and we had like the best lineup ever. And I had to do four interviews, but they were like fun and chill. And it was literally like 12 p.m. to 2 a.m. So I was very mentally drained afterward and had to catch my flight the next day. And that was like hell. I was hungover and I was like, what is my life? But it was really fun.
Who did you interview?
I interviewed Scowl, who I love, great hardcore band, Narrowhead, Squirrel Flower, and Echo Astral. A lot of fun stuff. It was just like these video interviews for the site. But luckily, I was off camera, which was a relief. I would be very anxious otherwise.
Yeah, so is it going to be like edited, like the title card will be the question, and then they'll be like,
Yes.
well, my answer is, yeah. That's cool. Yeah. I had serious FOMO. Like, what was also like, what was the vibe like, by the way? Because, like, the whole controversy with like genocide and the army sponsorship, I know like a lot of bands were pulling out of official showcases as a statement.
Yeah, there was definitely weird vibes, but also it was like my first South By, so I wasn't sure what it was like in previous years. But the Stereo Gum Showcase was unofficial, so luckily we were vibing and chilling. It was great. But yeah, it was crazy, especially because Squirrel Flower, who I interviewed, she was the first person to pull out and make a statement about it. And then Fox News like ran a story about it, and she was like getting attacked and like was scared of getting doxxed. So I felt really bad for her. But I mean, I don't know if I even went to, I only went to like a couple official showcases. And I mean, even artists who were performing at those were like on stage making a statement about it. So It's very interesting.
Yeah. Anyone who doxes Squirrel Flower deserves the death penalty.
She's so great. She's awesome. I love her.
Yeah. And that's gonna be like, how badass is like getting to live your life, like knowing that you made history as the first person to be like, nah.
It's so crazy though. I mean, there was Spin Magazine who literally did an event in collaboration with the army, and it's just like, dude, that's so fucking, it's just funny how stupid it is, but also so on brand with them because they don't have any morals.
Yeah. Also, who has read Spin magazine since 2010?
Dude, their website is so bad. Like their stories are like half of it is black text on white background, and then you scroll and it's black background, white text, which I hate. But either way, I don't know who is still reading them.
Yeah. Well, like in the current landscape where there's like so many like layoffs and a lot of the current climate for music journalists in particular, or anyone who works in media, is really like looking grim. What are some of like some people, some websites or anything that like gives you like solace where you're like these people are doing cool things and that gives me like hope for the future of journalism.
Feel like I should just say Stereo Gum. Read stereogum.com, support independent
Plug, plug,
media.
plug.
Man, I wish I fucking wrote a list to prepare for this. Oh, okay. Miranda Rainert is, she just recently launched her magazine and it is super cool. And I'm very excited for it. The first issue is coming soon, and it's gonna be in print too, which I'm super stoked for. Also, not journalism, but literary, new magazine called Angel Food, and they just launched their first issue online, and it's super cool. Lots of good writing. Okay, I did think of some. My mind wasn't that blank.
Yeah, Miranda, she's been a guest on the podcast. And I remember, like, at that time, like, she told me, oh, I'm moving away from like Wendy House for a little new press endeavor coming soon. Stay tuned. And I was like, oh, what could that be? And yeah, that's exciting that the first issue is launching soon.
Yeah, she's always doing cool stuff. She has the Endless Scroll podcast that's super sick. She's a good one.
Going back to the book, what I thought was really cool is how you use a bunch of songs as narrative devices. Were there any song mentions that in the editorial process you had to cut because they didn't serve their purpose?
Oh, no. My editor wouldn't do that to me. If anything, I think she probably would have wanted me to add more because I think I was a little hesitant to put some in. Like, I think the first one is Horse Jumper of Love, and I felt like really pretentious about it because they're like such a small band, and I don't want to like alienate people, but I also don't think being vague is the way to go. That's like gatekeeping. But I really loved the Fugazi and Elliott Smith references in it because I feel like more people get that sort of thing.
Yeah, that Horse Jumper of Love passage was, I think, one of my the most like memorable for me, just because like you would always sing along, it's a complicated luck, and then you found out it was actually lock, the words were lock, and then you were like, nah, bitch, it's fucking luck. I don't care what genius.com tells me.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I liked that did serve like a purpose. It had a meaning to it. Couldn't cut that one out.
Yeah, and Something that I think is really present and really like compelling about your writing, and something that's obviously a theme in the book too, is the allure of a self-destruction and the sort of contradictory like yearning for people to show their love by keeping the narrator at a distance, which was one of the most like compelling themes in the book to me. So what draws you to sort of disentangling and exploring that theme in your writing?
Well, I feel like a relationship where someone is like very distant is kind of self-destructive in a way, preferring to like want and never have that want satiated. That sort of feels like masochism. And I think when I stopped like getting belligerently drunk like almost a year ago in April last year, I realized like how entangled drinking and relationships were for me and how I kind of wanted just self-destruction from both of them. Like I never wanted something totally healthy because to me, I guess that was boring and both were a way to like fill a kind of void. So yeah, very, very entangled things.
I thought it was interesting as well how you sort of end the book on a cliffhanger where you feel like you're finally like out of the quicksand, as it were, and you're about to like call this on and off again ex and tell them like you suck. I can't why I you, here's the X and Y and Z reason why you suck and I'll never forgive you for what you did to me and yada yada yada, but then you pick up and hear the voice and you just want to go back to them and then the book ends. And so what sort of drew you to make that creative decision and end the book that way?
Well, I think I just it would have taken too much time to add what came next. Because when I turned it into my editor to ask like if she wanted to publish it, it was very different. And then I was basically just like rewriting it and editing it for like 2 years or something. And I was like close to the deadline. And I was like, I need to kind of pick an ending already. Like, I can't keep changing it and adding more. And I was contemplating adding more, but I don't think she would have let me. So I kind of like how it ends because it just captures the feeling of an on and off relationship to me. And I have like 10,000 more words of what came after because it finally did end, of course. We'll see what happens with that.
Sequel. I vote sequel.
Yeah, I was working on one for a bit, but I started writing like fiction books, and that is so much easier because I don't have to think about my own life. So, I don't know.
What type of fiction?
I've written two literary thrillers, kind of like the whole unhinged female protagonist thing that's going on right now. Yeah, I've been querying agents, trying to sell them for $300,000. Not going great yet, but hopefully soon.
Yeah, well, let's manifest it right now. Just
Thank
Danielle will
you.
get her $300,000. Danielle will get her $300,000.
Light some candles, listeners, light the candles.
So I also wanted to ask about your online diary slash Substack slash little hub, The Waiting Room, and what sort of purpose that serves in your personal output.
Yeah, it's like half secret. I don't know. I don't post a lot of my literary stuff on Twitter because I know most people just follow me for my journalism, and it's like I can't just be posting like these essays about having sex all the time on my Twitter. Like people will be weirded out. So it's mostly like Instagram based, I guess. But I feel like a lot of people don't read them, so I feel like I can just really write stuff honestly and just publish it on there. And I published two chat books through it, and those were very fun, very horny as well. But yeah.
Yeah, and when you're writing, I guess, like the more personal literary works, like I know you had the chat books, Cheat and Show Me Your Face. What kind of feedback have you gotten from readers? Because I'm sure that there's a lot of people, especially like girls, who connect with a lot of your work, especially like the fact that you're willing to really interrogate like all the internal entanglements. So like what has the feedback been like from readers?
Yeah, people really like it. They like that I'm really honest. And a lot of people are like, "You're so brave," or "I could never do that." And I'm like, "You can, though." And like, I'm not brave. I can't imagine like holding back stuff. Like, I think the whole point of art is to be real and, like you said, like interrogate. Like, I'm just always curious of like how honest I can be and like how much I can reveal. And I think people enjoy it because I guess they feel like they can't do it themselves, but they can. Yeah, but I'm always surprised when I get feedback because I just assume no one reads it, which is why it's easy for me to be honest. I just assume that no one's gonna read it. It's a nice little trick. Yeah.
And like you said, like you don't have to be like a braver, because like anyone can pick up a pen and open up a journal. Like, and like you said, like sort of treating it that way, like write as if nobody's reading it. Like, that's a good like way to really like be honest
I mean,
with readers and
I never write with like the idea of it being published. Like, I just write and I don't think about anything else.
right. Yeah. And what is, I'm curious to know, do you have any controversial hot takes on that are music related, be it like on a band or a genre or anything within the zeitgeist?
I definitely have a lot, but I feel like most of it is just that I have a lot more to explore. Like when people talk about The National, I get really annoyed, but like I haven't listened to them, so that's my fault. Same with Vampire Weekend. People rave about them, and all I know is like Oxford comma, which has always been annoying to me, or like A Punk. I don't know. I did recently get into Radiohead, so can't say anything about that. Hate the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Love Weezer. Choice Manor is the best band ever. That's not controversial, that's just a fact.
It's an objective fact.
Yeah, look it up. Think that's about it.
Yeah. I totally understand like the whole like anti Red Hot Chili Peppers thing. 'Cause like also like I grew up on them and I still have like some sort of reverence for the music and the talents of like John Frusciante and Flea, but the more you look into it, like the more you're just like, okay, Anthony Kiedis, why did you get Mike Patton removed from a festival because you were annoyed with something he said? Like, you're fucking with people's money at that point. Like, okay, like your music's already silly and kind of overrated, but now, like, you just suck.
Yeah, that's unsurprising. Also, the Smiths are better than the Cure. But if you know me, you already knew that. We'll say that.
To close out, what does the rest of the year have in store for you, and where can people find you online?
Follow my Twitter, which is Danielle Chalosky, but without the A, because my name is one letter too long for the username, so that's where I'm at. I'm also doing a reading on May 6th. I think it's the 6th at Our Wicked Lady. What else do I have? I can't think about the year. I don't know. Pre-Game and Grief finally came out, so I'm just happy that that is finally happening. That was a painful wait.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, everybody, I implore everybody to purchase a copy of the book because it's quite the read. And congratulations, by the way, on your first novel. Are you still 23?
Thank you. And yes, I am 23.
That is a milestone. Like your first novel at 23.
Thank you.
Thank you again for hopping on and chatting.
Thank you for sliding into my DMs and asking.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you to Danielle Chalosky for joining me for this episode. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.